You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, the 17th of January. Tuesday, that may feel like a Monday or may feel like a double Monday if you had a long weekend enjoying yesterday's day in celebration and honor of the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. Then today, probably even a little bit tougher to get up and get going for work. So God's grace and mercy, don't grow weary, as we've talked about today. Put one foot in front of the other. My pleasure to be with you. Hope you had a great weekend. I had a fairly relaxed one, though Saturday I was pretty much gone all day to Nashville, Tennessee, about a little 3 hours and some change south west of Lexington, where we broadcast from. Went down there with my daughter. Got this first time I'd been to the Parthenon down there in Nashville, which is the life-size replica of the, of course, the original in Athens. Nashville billing itself as the Athens of the West. But we were down there looking at apartments and the like for my daughter, who's wanting to hopefully move to Nashville and do like many, many, many other young people have done in Music City, try to make it as a singer-songwriter. So we had a good time, though. We went downtown Saturday night down to the kind of Music Row, you know, where the Ernest Tubb record shop is and where you have all the different bars and so forth. And my daughter with a couple with her sister and her friend who were with her, I stood outside with our 11-year-old daughter. It was a karaoke night. My daughter was put her name in the little slip of paper and the glass bowl was never drawn out. There were several groups, though, of drunk girls who got up to sing. I guess it was a bachelorette party or something. And I just thought, as the father of five daughters, if my daughters do that, please let me just be blissfully ignorant of that. Embarrassing. Anyway, but great to be back with you today. We're going to be talking here in about 13 minutes with Joseph Pierce. Joseph, who is an author, multi-published author, also writes for the Imaginative Conservative, and also works with Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee. He's going to be on to talk about Oscar Wilde's Scandalous Secret, and as well as an important question regarding a Trump presidency. So all that and more coming up on the program today. As I said yesterday, Martin Luther King Day. I remember my father, who God rest his soul. In fact, my dad will have been gone 30 years this summer, which is hard to believe. Died unexpectedly at the age of 49 of a heart attack back in 87. But my dad, a lot of people, like we all are, let's be honest, a man of his time, a child of his age. I mean, one of the things that sometimes gets me, you know, we spend a lot of time sometimes embarrassed by or apologizing for generations in the past, certain things they've done. And I think it's always worth asking, what will our future generations apologize for us for? Because believe me, every generation has its blind spots, no doubt about it. For my dad, who had grown up, you know, born in 38, you know, very much, my dad was not a virulently racist person. But certainly, you know, was not averse to the occasional bigoted remark. And, you know, we'd oftentimes get in arguments about it, which I, of course, always lost because I was the child, he was the dad. But he used to talk about Martin Luther King. My dad never waxed eloquently about it or defended his position, but he saw him as a troublemaker. Troublemaker, right? And certainly, I mean, no doubt, he created a lot of trouble for a lot of people, and not a perfect person by any means, but somebody who is an intellectual force to be reckoned with. If you've ever read much, letter from a Birmingham jail, some of the other writings. This guy was, he was not just a rabble rouser, Martin Luther King Jr. This was a guy who was a deep and profound thinker. But he was a troublemaker, and I guess when I see that, I don't see that as a bad thing or a bad term. We were talking last hour, today's Benjamin Franklin's birthday. I think I didn't realize he was born in 1706, which put him at age 70 at the time of the Declaration of Independence. Those men who together signed it and pledged their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor. Been very easy for Benjamin Franklin to see himself in the twilight of his life and not to want to attach his name to something that was really about a serious troublemaking and things that would upend a lot of things in his life, and yet he did. Martin Luther King Jr., like others, I'm sure, tempted to just let the sort of the slow arc of history bend toward justice and to give over to sort of a gradualism. Go along to get along and trust that in time justice would come, that promissory note would be fulfilled, and equality for all. But he chose instead, despite great personal cost and much more personal cost maybe than many knew, when he was shot on that hotel balcony in Memphis in April 1968. But being a troublemaker, we were talking last hour about the march, the Women's March coming up this weekend, and those who are pro-life who say no, to be pro-woman is not to be pro-abortion, and who are going to march in spite of the exclusivistic, intolerant attitude of the march organizers' approach, in which they're saying that, no, this is a pro-abortion march. If you oppose the euphemistically called reproductive rights, you cannot march. And yet there are those who will say we're there to make trouble, trouble of the good kind. This is the nature of what it is to be a Christian in the world, being willing to speak up and sometimes, when necessary, to cause trouble. So we certainly see Martin Luther King at the end of or continuing on in a pattern of a great tradition. How we continue to be that type of person in the world. 573-4BREAD-4, if you want to chime in. I'm asking a question of the day, as I said, about the film Patriots Day, which is out in theaters now with Mark Wahlberg, reliving the events from less than 4 years ago of the Boston Marathon bombing by the Tsarnaev brothers. There are those in Boston who feel like it's too soon. What do you think? Too soon? 573-4BREAD-4. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Today's feast day, the feast of St. Anthony the Abbot. St. Anthony the Great, he's called. He comes before St. Anthony of Padua, the St. Anthony we typically associate with lost things. But St. Anthony was the father of monks and retired to the desert at the age of 18 in order to live in perfect solitude. As Catholic culture here says, he laid the foundations of community life and gave to his disciples that profound, broad, and sane instruction, the mature result of solitude and prayer, which forms the surest basis of Christian asceticism. Had profounding influence, of course, upon succeeding generations. So St. Anthony the Great, pray for us. Back to the readings for today. The first reading, as I said, the letter to the Hebrews. We have this call from the writer to not grow sluggish, but to imitate those who through faith and patience are inheriting the promises. And here's how we can be sure, by the way, of God's promises. It continues on, when God made the promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself and said, I will indeed bless you and multiply you. See, as you recall, and Abraham's lifted up in more detail in chapter 11, the Great Hall of Faith, as one who persevered, who continued on, who left what was secure and familiar to go to a land the Lord would show him.
and it would take him a while until finally the gift that had been promised of progeny like the stars in the sky, despite his elderly status and the infertility he and his wife had experienced, he now beyond childbearing years, it would take 25 years before the promised child would come, and a lot of detours along the way, including the perhaps well-intentioned but poorly chosen decision to father a child through his maidservant, Hagar, or Sarah's maidservant. But I love this line. He had no greater power by whom to swear God. He swore by himself. Usually when we swear by something greater. You know, I swear on my mother's grave. I swear on this. I swear to God, for example. God, no such alternative, because he is, by definition, by nature, that of whom there is nothing greater. He is the source of all reality. So God swore by himself. I remember that line from, this is a movie back from the 70s in which George Burns played God, the film Oh God, and he actually ended up testifying in court. And when he swore, was sworn in as a witness, he said, "So help me, me." No one greater to swear by than himself. God, you'll recall, through covenants with Abram, including one particularly memorable moment when a torch and a flaming pot passed between halves of animals that had been sawn in two. God swearing by himself. Now, why would God make a promise? He doesn't have to. He's God. He makes promises because he loves us. And whatever his promise is to us, the inheritance we have in Christ, he's sworn by himself. By his own blood, he will not fail to give. So don't lose heart. We'll be back in a minute with Joseph Pierce. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, the 17th. Pleased to be joined from via phone from beautiful South Carolina, the Palmetto State. My guest, Joseph Pierce. He's a senior contributor at the Imaginative Conservative and writer in residence and director of the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee. His works include G.K. Chesterton, Wisdom and Innocence, Literary Converts, Tolkien, Man and Myth, Solzhenitsyn, A Soul in Exile, The Quest for Shakespeare and Old Thunder, A Life of Hilaire Belloc, senior editor of the Ignatius Critical Conditions as well, and the editor of the St. Austin Review. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, Mike.
Great to have you here. Let's talk about your article in the Imaginative Conservative, and there's so many. I mean, it's like you can't go wrong. It's like grabbing from a candy grab bag, but this one on Oscar Wilde's Scandalous Secret. Maybe refresh our memory a little bit just on who Oscar Wilde was.
Yeah, Oscar Wilde was technically an Irish writer who lived in London and wrote plays, one very famous novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and poetry, he's sort of remembered really for the scandal in his life, which is where he basically deserted his wife and two children to have to sort of indulge in the homosexual lifestyle. It all ended rather sordidly, and he ended up doing 2 years in prison. And one of the sad things is that he's very much remembered by most people, perhaps, for that scandal and not for his marvelous works and for his conversion to the faith.
Yeah, he is kind of, I guess, lifted up as sort of a celebration of a libertine, the libertine pursuit, not being encumbered by societal expectations of sexuality and all the rest. But inside was a guy who was in turmoil.
Exactly. I mean, the sort of liberals hold Wilde up as someone who is persecuted for his so-called sexuality, for his homosexuality, whereas that is not the case whatsoever. He was not imprisoned for that, except insofar as he shot himself in the foot. But that's a rather convoluted details, which really we don't have time to talk about here. I would perhaps refer people to my book, The Unmasking of Oscar Wilde, if they want to know the full details of the court case and the prison sentence and what it was all about. But it certainly isn't the way that it's presented. And as you quite rightly say, that the unmasking of Oscar Wilde, that when you get beneath the surface of Oscar Wilde, you have a man who had a lifelong love affair with the Catholic faith from his time as an undergraduate right through to his deathbed conversion. And I think the most interesting thing about Oscar Wilde is the fact that he realized that that a life in the gutter was not a life that was suited to any man, and that we need to be looking at the stars. And in fact, there's a character in one of his plays that says we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. And yes, Wilde was in the gutter for much of his life, and he knew it, but he knew that the stars were somewhere that was a much better place to be, to be looking towards the heavens, and of course towards the God that made the heavens.
You know, isn't it interesting? Because we see this phenomenon a lot, Joseph, with persons who become sort of cultural icons. We oftentimes, the way we view a person culturally, you know, through our culture, says more about us, perhaps, than what it says about them. We see this with people like Andy Warhol, for example, another person who, had some Catholic desires within himself. I mean, we certainly know that for all of us, we don't want to be known by our vices. We'd rather be known by our virtues.
Right. And, you know, the point is that all of us have this struggle going on that is like a civil war, if you like, in our hearts and minds, because on the one hand, we're made in the image of God, which means we aspire towards the divine and desire the divine. On the other hand, we're prone through original sin to concupiscence, which lowers our sights and brings us down into the gutter. But, you know, what comes first, of course, is the divine image, not the fall. So for most people, and for all people except those that allow themselves to become so corrupt that they've lost all sensibility to the good, the true, and the beautiful. And thankfully, that, I think, is a small minority of our brothers and sisters. For the vast majority, they know that evil acts are doing harm both to themselves and to those that they do evil acts with, and they desire virtue, they desire the good, they desire the true, and they desire the beautiful. And we see that in the life of Oscar Wilde, and that's what I was trying to accentuate in my articles. Oscar Wilde was someone that always knew the difference between right and wrong, and indeed in his work he's always on the side of the angels, even if it's in his life he sometimes succumbed to the temptation of devils.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more detail in terms of his own life. You say he almost converted when he was an undergraduate as a young man.
Yes, I mean, he went to his parents, as were most Irish Protestants, were very anti-Catholic. His father, particularly, very anti-Catholic. His mother sort of flirted with Catholicism for a while and then turned her back on it. But he went to Trinity College in Dublin and started mixing with priests and discovering the truths of the Catholic faith. And when his father realized he was flirting with Catholicism, shipped him off to Oxford to escape the clutches of the priests in Dublin, only of course to find that in Oxford, under the influence of John Henry Newman, blessed John Henry Newman, and the Oxford movement, that Oxford was itself, if you like, a hotbed of Catholicism and converts to Catholicism. And Wilde showed a great desire to convert as an undergraduate at Oxford. He went to Mass regularly. He discussed Catholic doctrine and apologetics with his fellow students, some of whom did convert. And the only reason he didn't convert at that stage, as he said later, was because his father threatened to disinherit him. If he actually succumbed to the Scarlet Woman of Rome, he would be disinherited. And Wilde, not for the first time and not for the last time, chose the worldly path rather than the high road and paid for it.
We're talking with Joseph Pierce, senior contributor at the Imaginative Conservative and multiply published author, also the works for the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College. As you say, you know, of course, he because of concerns about his father's disinheriting him and all the rest, did not follow his desire. Later in life, he was, when he, not only was he received into the church, but there were many others, other so-called decadents who found their way into the church as well.
Yeah, the ironic thing is, that most of the decadent movement, or most of the major lights in the so-called decadent movement in both France and England, converted to Catholicism, and I sometimes look upon this as the path of the sinner. I sometimes call it the Mary Magdalene path. That these writers and poets and artists went so deep into the sordid depths of their own hearts and into the gutter of life and discovered the existence of the devil and recalled in horror into the loving arms of Mother Church. So, for instance, just to give some names, in the French decadence, which preceded the English decadence in terms of time, Charles Baudelaire, the father of the French decadence, was received into the church on his deathbed. Paul Verlaine, who deserted his wife and child to have a homosexual fling and went to prison after shooting his homosexual lover, had a conversion experience in prison, converted to Catholicism, and wrote some wonderful Catholic poetry thereafter. The French decadent novelist Joris Cole Huysmans was a convert to Catholicism and spent the last years of his life in a monastery. And crossing the channel into England, apart from Oscar Wilde, we have the decadent poet John Gray, who became a priest. He was the model for Dorian Gray, the character in Wilde's novel. He became a priest. Lionel Johnson was a convert to Catholicism. The artist Aubrey Beardsley was a convert to Catholicism. Ernest Dowson, the Catholic decadent poet, was a convert to Catholicism. And I actually could go on and on and on. Even Lord Alfred Douglas, the man who sort of the fair with Oscar Wilde led to Wilde's imprisonment, he also became a Catholic. So, basically these people, if you like, flirted with the devil, danced with the devil, realized actually that hell existed and did the wise and prudent thing and fled from hell into the arms of Holy Mother Church.
I love your line here. It says, when all of Wilde's fair-weather friends abandoned him, this was late in his life. And, of course, Wilde died very young, right? He was less than 50 years old.
Yes, 46, right.
He said it was another convert to Catholicism, Robert Ross, who was the very man who's thought to have first introduced Wilde to homosexual practice. It was Ross who stood by him and fetched the priest who would receive Wilde into the church.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. I didn't mention Robert Ross, as you say. You've just summed up his role and who he was very, very succinctly there. But, really, this is a, if you wrote a novel about this, people would say, nothing like this happens in real life. But, Oscar Wilde's life and the world in which he moved and his happy ending by being received into the Catholic Church is stranger than fiction, because truth is stranger than fiction, of course, because it's made by God. All of our fiction are really reflections of the truth, and pale reflections of that.
It's a great reminder, and all we have to do is look in the gospel to the criminal being crucified next to Christ. I mean, we're never too late. It's never too late while we have breath in our bodies to turn and to be enveloped in the mercy of God.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a wonderful metaphor, because I sometimes say that all of humanity is crucified on Golgotha with Christ, because all of us will suffer. There's no escape from suffering. It's what we do with that suffering. Are we going to be like the bad thief and curse God and curse our neighbor and curse everybody for the sufferings in our life? Are we going to be like the good thief and realize that, that suffering is caused by our own sin and the sins of others, and to ask God for mercy and support and to ask him to help us carry our crosses? And we all face that choice. Are we going to be the bad thief, or are we going to be the good thief?
Joseph, can you hold on through the break? We'll be back in a minute. We'll talk about the president being inaugurated this Friday and a question you ask on the Imaginative Conservative blog. Can you hold on?
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute from beautiful South Carolina. Joseph Pierce, this is the Mike Allen Show, and you're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show on this Tuesday, the 17th, Feast of St. Anthony the Great, St. Anthony the Abbot, joined by Joseph Pierce from beautiful South Carolina, senior contributor at the Imaginative Conservative and writer in residence and director of the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College in Nashville, Tennessee. Posted links to the articles we're discussing on the show's Facebook page. You got to check out the Imaginative Conservative. Always good thought-provoking stuff. Let's shift gears a little bit, Joseph. Thanks for holding on during the break. Let's talk about Donald Trump, who will be inaugurated. I still can't even believe I'm saying those words. He will be inaugurated as the President of the United States this Friday. And one, I guess, criterion by which we can judge him is, as you say in your article, is will he be a nationalist or an imperialist? Let's kind of walk through what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think one of the dangers of, you know, the rhetoric of patriotism and let's make America great again is that America actually becomes an imperialist nation, and an imperialism is a form of internationalism. So one can't claim on the one hand to be a nationalist, one who embodies the ideal of the nation in one's politics, and also be an imperialist, which is an internationalist. To try to explain it, basically a true nationalist merely wants his own country to be a beacon of light for others, other countries to emulate or to respect, whereas an imperialist actually imposes his political will on other nations against those nations' wills, and that's a form of internationalism. When one nation imposes its will upon another nation, it's an internationalism, which I think is 9 times out of 10 at least detrimental to world peace and certainly harmful to the freedom and independence of the smaller nation, which is being imposed upon.
You know, it's an interesting delineation you make there too, because you know nationalism viewed by some largely as the cause of much of the 20th century's heartache. You know, with the rise of nationalism and of course with it a despotic tyranny and therefore the aggressive moves by nations like Germany, let's say, or Soviet Russia and so forth. But you actually argue that it wasn't nationalism that brought the two great world wars. It was actually imperialism.
Yes, it's basically, at root it's secularism, and imperialism is a bitter fruit of secularism. Imperialism is where, you know, the political ambitions of one nation impose itself upon another. So the Nazis were not nationalists in spite of their name. They were internationalists because they imposed their will upon their neighboring countries. They marched into the Czechoslovakia, they marched into Poland, and that's an act of imperialism against Joseph Stalin when he invaded the countries of Eastern Europe is an imperialist. And it's normally imperialism, which is a form of internationalism, which causes wars. And nationalism is normally the efforts by independent nations or enslaved nations, I should say, to regain their independence. So in one sense, you know, Donald Trump's concerns over globalism and globalization and how that is destroying the U.S. economy, well, that's the voice of a nationalist seeking to liberate America from the encroachment of economic imperialism from these global entities. But you know, going around the world and hitting people over the head because we disagree with the government of those countries is not the same thing as liberating ourselves from globalism. So we need to know the difference, and we need to know the difference between the genuine national interests of the United States and merely imperialistic ambition.
You know, this last presidential election really created a lot of hand-wringing from a lot of Catholics, because both candidates had their own problems and issues. But I guess you could say with Donald Trump, despite, of course, the many concerns that I and others have, the things that he tapped into, you would be wrong to say that there wasn't some legitimacy to some of the points that he was making.
Well, yeah, and the most important thing is that regardless of what you think of Donald Trump, the fact that the majority of the U.S. voters were unhappy with the establishment parties. In other words, that Donald Trump was not the Republican Party's official choice by any means. And again, the Bernie Sanders phenomenon in the Democrat Party showed that people were unhappy with the corruption of the political system. And I think that's good. I mean, that sort of populism is good. The trouble with populism is it can be led by tyrants and by demagogues, and that's a concern, and that's why I think that we need to be vigilant. Okay, Donald Trump is president, and certainly I'm relieved that Hillary Clinton is not president.
That'd be a scandal, wouldn't it?
I think that many people voted for Trump not because they were pro-Trump, but because they were anti-Hillary. But we do now need to be able to judge Donald Trump on the basis of what is right and wrong. And so establishing those criteria are important. And one of the reasons for my writing that article about the difference between nationalism and imperialism for the imaginative conservative was to be able to sort of delineate, you know, how are we going to judge Donald Trump as President of the United States in his actions? And if insofar as he's a genuine nationalist, we should be supportive. Insofar as he's an imperialist, we shouldn't.
You know, it's an interesting place to be as a Catholic, because it is this whole idea of when you talk about nationalism, imperialism. And I know you're a big fan, as I am, of G.K. Chesterton. And he often talked about the nature of Christian patriotism, because particularly as Catholics, that word which means universal, and certainly we are part of a church that transcends national lines and national boundaries. How do we sort of, identify, let's say, with our homeland on the one level as citizens of our country, but also remember that we are part of a global church, right, that transcends national lines?
Yeah, well, that's an extremely good question. Well, the first thing, of course, is that all Catholics and indeed all Christians must insist always that the government of any nation is under God. In other words, that the sovereignty, ultimate political sovereignty, resides with God and not with man, and with God and not with Caesar. And if we're forced to choose loyalties between God and Caesar, we must choose God. Now, that's why the duty of Caesar is to not put himself at war with God. So government has to be under God. That's the first thing. But as regards nations and patriotism, you know, the Catholic Church does teach subsidiarity, which means that political freedom is best served at as local a level as possible. So we really want the revitalization and reinvigoration of local government. And on a global level, nations are local government. And now within nations, I'd like to see the reinvigoration of local government within nations. That's subsidiarity. That's what the Catholic Church teaches. But really, the nation state is local government on a global level, and that's much more conducive to political freedom than having a one world government, which would be a tyranny.
Well, it almost becomes a one world government, almost sort of a secular counterfeit of the universal church.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Catholic Church receives its authority from Christ himself. Caesar does not have that authority and has no right to seize it. And consequently, you know, Christians need to be on the guard against the usurping of power by Caesar, by the secular authorities. And certainly the idea that we could have one government governing the whole world would be anything but a tyranny, in which the individual voter would be so far removed from the organs of government that he would be effectively voiceless. And that's an abandonment of any pretense at democracy.
Well, let's really quick shift gears and talk about the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth, of course, because you also wrote a piece, and this is an interesting sort of segue, because you thought her Christmas message was a particularly poignant and really beautiful portrayal of the role of a ruler in seeking the best for her people.
Yes, I mean, I think as Queen Elizabeth II, who's now 90 years old, gets older, she seems to be much more upfront about her Christianity. And this year's Christmas speech was you know, overtly Christian, unapologetically Christian, and praised, for instance, Saint Teresa of Calcutta. She praised the fact that Mother Teresa had been canonized, and talked about lessons we can learn from Mother Teresa and from the Christian faith. And I think that in some ways, because she's the monarch, she doesn't have to make any sort of this genuflecting before the unholy power of secularism. So I found it healthy that, if you like, in the UK with this sort of constitutional monarchy, that the Queen can actually be a counter voice to the government, and that constitutionally she does actually still have powers, which I suggested she should think about using, because I think it would be a corrective. And the Queen, of course, could only be successful in that insofar as she had the people behind her. That's the point. So she couldn't just do anything tyrannical. But if she sensed that the people were against something the government were doing and spoke out against it, the government would be forced to back down. So she's actually, in many ways, ironically, perhaps, and paradoxically, that the monarchy is a democratic force in the United Kingdom, which I think is paradoxical and also marvelous.
Well, maybe we can hope that our president-elect maybe will learn a little bit from the Queen.
Well, please God.
we got to be people of hope, Joseph, right?
Well, yes, and also we do believe in miracles, don't we, Mike?
That's exactly right. Hey, thanks for taking time, Joseph, and then for your great work. I'm a big fan, admirer, and blessings to you and your family and all the great work you're doing, as well as at Aquinas College.
Thanks so much, and God bless you and your work.
All right. We'll be back with more on the other side of the break. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, among other things. This is the Mike Allen Show, and you're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Joseph Pierce, who I just had this conversation with, if you missed it, you want to check out the podcast, author of The Imaginative Conservative, works the Center for Faith and Culture at Aquinas College, multi-published author. He's one of those guys that, my goodness, has a depth of knowledge of a whole lot of different things and a lot of fun to talk to, and a great witness for the faith as well. So thanks to Mr. Pierce for taking time for us this morning. Again, my question of the day relates to the film Patriots Day, which is out now in theaters, depicting the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing and the aftermath, not being received that well in Boston, according to a New York Times piece, because they see it as too soon and verging on exploitation, though it does star Mark Wahlberg in the lead role, who is a Boston native. And that's my question of the day. Do you think it's too soon for a movie depiction of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing? John says, of course it's too soon. In this case, a lot of the potential audience for the film would be walking in the theater carrying a lot of political / religious baggage that they're going to want validated. Not sure precisely what he means, except maybe, you know, that tendency to blame all Muslims, for example, or immigrants and so forth. David says too soon. So if you've got to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4. By the way, we need your help here at Breadbox, trying to get the word out about our network and what we're about. We would love to have a short selfie video. When I say short, I mean like 30 seconds of something that you could say on camera of why you like Breadbox Media, why you would encourage others to maybe download the app or listen to the stream or the podcast. You could mention even a show or two that you listen to on the thing. If you want to do that, just send it to me via email, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, and Leo, our general manager, is going to kind of edit them together into one montage. If you want more information, you're not quite sure what we were looking for, then you can shoot me an email as well, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Before the long weekend, William Peter Blatty died, age 89, the author, of course, of The Exorcist, a book published in 1971, which sold more than 13 million copies. I guess at the time, Blatty was 43 years old, had already had a a little bit of a career as a comedy writer. When he wrote The Exorcist, of course, is he said, the sad truth is nobody wants me to write comedy anymore. The Exorcist not only ended that career, it expunged all memory of its existence. It's interesting that this death comes because, if you recall, maybe within a week or within the last couple of weeks, I think it was over the Christmas break, I watched The Exorcist for the first time since becoming Catholic. I'd seen it as a teenager, and it had petrified me, the film. I could never watch it again after that. But I saw where it was on one night. I was flipping around, and there it was. And I thought, you know, I've always heard that there are serious Catholic overtones in this film. Of course, I need to watch it again through Catholic eyes. And I did. And I have to say, it changed the movie for me. Not that there aren't horrific aspects of it, and not for the faint of heart by any stretch of the imagination. But it's a movie actually much more laden with hope than I remembered, and I'm assuming that comes from the book. I kind of want to read the book. Anyway, Blatty gave various accounts of what made him want to try his hand at horror. He said he sometimes said the market for his comedy had waned in the late 60s, and he was ready to move on. But at other times, he said that his mother's sudden death in 1967 had led to a renewed commitment to his Roman Catholic faith and to a soul-searching about life's ultimate questions, including the presence of evil in the world. There's a beautiful scene, of course, at the end of the film. I'm not sure whether it's in the book, when one of the father, the priest who ends up jumping out the window after being filled with a demon himself who dies, one of his colleagues comes by the house. And Ellen Burstyn, of course, who plays the mother, and her daughter Reagan, played by Linda Blair, are getting into a car to move to a new house. And the little girl, 12, now freed from the demonic, sees the priest's collar. And she gives him a hug and I think a kiss on the cheek. I thought that was a particularly poignant and beautiful scene. So rest in peace, William Peter Blatty. You, through your presentation of The Darkness, perhaps open the door for some light. Another interesting article that I happened to come across, this from the AP. Gay teacher sues over firing from North Carolina high school. A gay teacher has sued a Roman Catholic school on Wednesday for firing him after he announced his wedding to a man, the latest in a series of legal fights over anti-discrimination protections for LGBT people. This is going to be a bellwether case in many ways, because we talk about religious freedom, we talk about the ministerial exception and so forth, which the Supreme Court upheld in a unanimous vote in a certain situation. But here's going to be the tricky thing in terms of how the courts see it. Will the courts, in a sense, subdivide out the types of employees that a Catholic school hires? So, for example, somebody who doesn't teach religion, will the government see them, therefore, as being free to live lives that are in contradiction with Catholic moral teaching? Meanwhile, the church, I'm assuming, will, in fighting these lawsuits, will insist that every teacher in a Catholic school, no matter whether they're explicitly teaching religion or not, because of the way we view the faith, that it is Catholic, it's universal, it involves every aspect. It's not just one piece of how we look at the world. It animates everything. Therefore, one's own personal witness as a Catholic high school teacher matters. Therefore, you can't be publicly in odds with Catholic teaching and be a faithful Catholic high school teacher. But I can already tell you what's going to be the argument from the other side. Well, if that's the case, then why do you hire non-Catholic teachers? If every teacher is, in a sense, a religion teacher, no matter the subject they teach, why would you hire those who are not Catholic? So this is going to be an interesting sort of test case regarding Charlotte Catholic. Evidently, the school fired Lonnie Billard from a substitute teaching role in 2014 after a 2000 after a Facebook post about his wedding. Evidently, he taught English and drama full-time at the school for more than a decade and then transitioned to a role as a regular substitute teacher. Now, the interesting thing is, and we may have to get into this a little bit more tomorrow, his attorneys argued that it was sort of common knowledge among everybody. He says, in fact, Billard says, I've never hidden the fact that I'm gay, and my relationship with my partner was no secret at school. I'm starting to get a little bit more clarity about what went down with Sister Jane Dominic of the Nashville Dominicans. If you recall this story, because it all coincides, who was giving a talk about human sexuality to the student body brought in by a priest at the school. She gave a talk in which she presented Catholic teaching about the nature of homosexual acts. Now, where Sister Jane Dominic, and we've talked about this on the program before, may have been imprudent is when she ventured over into things like psychology and sociology, which evidently many of the students found very offensive. And she was highly criticized by parents. She even, the Nashville Dominicans, the Sisters of St. Cecilia, of which she's a member, actually put her on leave and said that she ventured outside of her areas of expertise. Now I'm beginning to see a little bit of clarity that part of the reason her talk was so poorly received is perhaps because of this teacher, Mr. Hillard, who was known by the student, or Billard, I'm sorry, who was known by the students to be gay and accepted as such. So we'll talk about this a little bit more tomorrow, but this is starting to get a little more clarity to what the firestorm was regarding Sister Jane Dominic and her presentation. Very, very interesting. And like I said, this is going to be a very, I think, significant court case with terms of ramifications. We're going to go on to spin the dollar catechism wheel. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator, spin up a number between 1 and 2865, total number of paragraphs in the catechism. We'll see what Providence has in store for us, knowing, of course, truth is never random, always integrated within the panorama of truth. 2015 is the paragraph. Almost there. Here we go. This is in the section, the third pillar, life in Christ or the moral life. The way of perfection passes by way of the cross. There is no holiness without renunciation and spiritual battle. Spiritual progress entails the ascesis, or is that ascesis? In other words, the root of ascetic, and mortification that gradually lead to living in the peace and joy of the Beatitudes. Here's a great quote from St. Gregory of Nyssa. He who climbs never stops going from beginning to beginning, through beginnings that have no end. He never stops desiring what he already knows. In other words, it's about dying to ourselves, but not as an end in itself, but that we may detach ourselves from lesser goods in order to embrace deeper goods. And it will not come without battle. If you thought the path to holiness was going to be easy, all sweetness and light, time to put on your big boy pants. It's going to be a war, because we have an enemy who desires our defeat, even our own sinful desires as well. So by God's grace, carry us forward. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to BreadBox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. BreadBox Media. Get the app, change the world.